Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Alan Williams. Williams is currently a professor of music at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, a position he'll retire from later in 2026. He's just released his third solo album, Floating on the Dreamline, and we discuss that as well as his time in the academic world, including his spearheading of the UMass Lowell Album Ensembles Project, for which Williams has guided students through rehearsals and recordings of classic albums such as King Crimson's Red and Radiohead's In Rainbows. We also get to his thoughts on the world of prog and pop musics, his thoughts on his upcoming retirement, and what became of saxophone solos in pop songs. That's Alan Williams on Into Music, coming up now. You do this UMass album project?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, it's a lot of work. And when I'm in the middle of it, I pretty much hate everyone and everything. I hate the album. I hate my students. I hate my life. And then when it's done, I can step back and go, wow, they're awesome. They did great. Yeah. We stumbled into it, you know, as sort of an artifact of trying to figure out how to do things during the pandemic. So I'd started the album Ensembles before the pandemic, and we were just doing concerts. And then when we knew we couldn't meet face to face, I proposed that we do something where, at the time, people were making those Brady Bunch videos of lots of everybody's little faces in the screen. And I thought, well, maybe we could do a Pink Floyd multi-tracked kind of, I don't know. And all that semester, we would have these weekly Zoom meetings and sort of suss out who's covering what parts on what songs. And we had a really lame little software program that I'd say, go ahead and practice your part, maybe upload it so I can tell if you've got the right chords or whatever. And parallel to that, for my own music, I decided to rent a workspace because my wife and I live in a tiny little condo, and trying to teach lessons, you know, classes, and it just was like, okay, we're really in each other's hair, it's not fair. So I found a big space and thought, okay, we could do live streaming for music here. I can put lights up in the ceiling, and I had some former students with AV companies, and I thought, everybody's hurting, maybe I can buy any gear they don't want or whatever, and we can, which is what we did. And so it occurred to me towards the end of that semester that I could maybe build little plastic ISO booths, and we could bring the students in small groups and overdub everybody, kind of like if you were going to make Dark Side of the Moon, they did lots of overdubbing. We'd do the same thing. I wanted it to be performative, and yet we couldn't put everybody in the same room. So I could bring the rhythm section in, five or six people maybe, and we would just track the album instrumentally, and then bring in the vocalist, and the crucial part was, especially the like sax player or occasional vocalist, it would be like, all right, so us and them is 8 minutes long, and your part doesn't come in till 6 minutes. So just enjoy the 6 minutes, because we're going to track as one continual performance, no matter what, we have to do it that way. There is one live thing on the Dark Side performance, and that's Great Gig in the Sky, where I thought they got to be live. So we, and they didn't need the whole group. I think I overdubbed the slide guitars. That's what we did. But bass, drums, piano, and the three vocalists. And it's all one take and one camera move. And I remember I'm having my little camera and I'm walking around the singers, and they so nailed it. In fact, the lead singer, her better take, I think the band screwed up on. So be it. But it's like, I remember we finished the performance and I cut out the part where I fall to my knees and go, oh my God, you guys, that was amazing. But we still didn't really know what we had. I put it together and we screened it we made like a Zoom premiere for the music department and the folks in the ensemble and anybody else, family or whatever they wanted to see. And I remember I hit play and we watched the whole thing. And I was like, okay, so that's it. I don't know. And I said, any feedback from that? And there was just like no response at all for a moment. And I thought, oh, maybe I even forgot to hit play. I don't know. What happened? What happened? And then my sister logged on and she said, I don't know what I just saw, but I'm crying. And we realized that I think in that pandemic moment, we got a ton of views from it. The keyboard player, somehow we got it on the AV club and it just went around. It's because everybody was in isolation. And you can watch the students making music together and the sheer joy on their faces, just that they're able to do it at all. I think it's palpable. You can hear it, you can see it. And it was really moving. And so it became a thing. I had to do it every semester, every year. We would do these album projects and they got more elaborate. We got to the place where we could do them all with everybody, obviously. The year that we did Talking Heads, our concert hall was being renovated, so we filmed it at a rock club, live audience. And we did, I think, three or two, no, we did two concerts, and I took the best takes out of whichever evening. But those are totally live. They're not the most visually fantastic because it was hard to get onto the stage, but there's there. My favorite is the Radiohead in Rainbows because we sort of were emulating the Radiohead from the basement thing. So the group is in a circle facing each other on the stage, but we sealed off with a curtain and we put the audience sort of in bleachers on the far wings behind the stage. So we could get all the, could get cameras close. And I warned the audience, we're doing this more for the taping than for you guys. So we're going to run the whole album. We may try to run it. If we didn't like a song, we might do it again, but blah, 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 blah. So it's to me that the ideal thing of, okay, I've got control over the audio, I've got better camera shots, and there's still an audience. So the students are getting the feedback from that. What I didn't realize when we chose Radiohead, I knew, okay, computer, that's the first one we did. That'll be flashy, it'll be fun, we'll make that work. And then when I got to In Rainbows, it's so hard. I thought stuff like Dark Side of the Moon or Remain in Light was hard. No, that's kindergarten. In Rainbows is deceptively complicated. And the reason it's complicated is that it requires all this precise alignment of all these different musicians doing different things that aren't really clear-cut, standard, just play the chords. So we were struggling mightily in rehearsals. I was almost like, I don't know, maybe we should just cancel the show. I don't know. And then like a week before, we had a pretty good run through and we did a show, went pretty well. We did a second show, it went very well. And I knew between the first two shows, I pretty much had good performances of the album, one way or the other. So for the last show, I just told them, all right, you guys, I think we got it. So stop worrying, go out and enjoy yourselves. And that's most of what you see is the last show where they just do it. And the last song of that album is Videotape, which is sort of like a song. I think it's kind of an aural suicide note. But the woman who's singing, she was a grad student. She'd been there for 6 years. It was going to be her last performance at the school. And so the last verse is sort of, no matter what happens now, it's going to be okay. I'm going to move on. And you see her just completely choke up and think about her life in that moment. I don't know, there's just so much real stuff happening that I come back to that one.
Wow.
All right, I'll take a breath.
No, it's just fascinating to me. So we do have, and I know we're going to talk about your album, but we do have an audio engineering program now here at Wichita State, and my assistant engineer teaches in it. But he and I have all these conversations about, like, we want to see the students in the program like find different ways to socialize and different ways to work on projects and so forth, because we are both of an age that so much of our social life was music.
Right. Yeah. And you're right. I mean, it's like they're students and they're in classes together, but that's not quite the same thing. There's nothing like being in a band, right? Even if it's ad hoc, you don't know half the people. In fact, when we did the first Pink Floyd one, there was a guy that had transferred into the program. He'd never met any of the people that he was playing with, and I didn't know it. So we had done like a whole mornings of recording, and finally he leaned over and he goes, hi everybody, my name's Joel. I haven't met you, but it's really great to be here. And I was like, oh my God, wow. It's interesting because it's often like a cast of characters that would not necessarily have chosen one another. And part of what we forge is that sense of a group identity. And when we did that, we would do tapings like over a long weekend, like almost like, you know, when you're in your garage band and you're making your demo tape and you book the studio for 2 days and you got to get it done, right? So that's how we would do these projects. And you meld over that. I think people that had never met or spoken to each other have no other connection. By the end of it, they are a collective, and it's a beautiful thing to see. So that's a really nice byproduct of the process.
We have been trying to develop a class where I'll kind of talk about like the social context. Like, I don't know, for off the top of my head, the first Boston album. And then Torn will talk about like the techniques and then try to get them to somehow emulate them. Because the other thing is that their listening habits are different too.
Very different. Absolutely. I mean, I love their broadly eclectic taste. They'll listen, my students will, they'll listen to anything. They'll identify stuff they like. It's so decontextualized in a way that they're able to like the most unhip thing. If they happen to like it, they like it. But their sense that there can be broader context for all this stuff is increasingly foreign, you know? I mean, I remember growing up and thinking, I'm not cool enough to buy the Sex Pistols album. So that's just going to have to wait because I'm not that and I don't deserve it. It's such a weird, and I say this to my students and they're like, what is your problem? That's crazy. It makes no sense to them. But yeah, I think maybe of our generation, there's the social aspect of music. And on the opposite side was the really private thing where you could put on the headphones, so you're not bothering the family. And you're listening to the album, get the album in your lap, you're looking at the lyrics. Or I remember listening to Dark Side of the Moon and drawing with colored ink pens, just, you know, whatever you could do to occupy, but your focus was so intensely the music. And I feel like with my students now, and even people that are in these audio programs, it's like, it's hard to say, just listen to this, deeply listen to this. For 30 seconds, maybe, but 2 minutes in, and you're like, do not touch that phone. Do not touch that phone. It's so hard, you know.
Wow.
Anyway, it's great that you've got those kind of programs. We do too at UML. And it's, in fact, the recording program has been the thing that's kind of held the music program together over these decades because we've had a very strong one for many, many decades now. And it's part of what attracts students to the university for us. And of course, those programs have to shift over time to keep up both of the technologies, but even more so with these differences in approach and career paths and those sorts of things. It's a very different landscape than it was when I first started teaching there.
There's a young musician in town. I've known him, I'm embarrassed to say, how long, because I feel old when I realize that. But, you know, he really wanted to, like, he recognized that at a certain point he wasn't always going to be able to tour with his band, and so he wanted to start recording. But then he was one of the first people I knew who was like, I need to learn audio, or I need to learn video editing. And
Yes.
everybody was like, why? And he's like, because they're going to be interlocked from now on.
We brought back alumni to the sound recording program. Maybe it was our 25th anniversary of the program. I don't know. Some time ago, 10, 15 years ago. And I made a little presentation and I said, all right, audio and video, just consider that one word. There's no distinction. If you don't know one, you got to have them both. You just, from now on, whether we're talking music videos, which nobody even cares about, but gaming, blah, 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 blah. It's just, this is before really social media as a way of presenting oneself. But now, like, yeah, now that I'm also creating music, you're like, ugh, you got to feed the social media beast. And I don't think the world needs to know what I had for dinner. I don't find it that interesting. I don't think that you do either. So instead, I'm thinking, okay, what do we do with audio and visual elements to try to put things out there? And, you know, I make some old school music videos, but these things like that album ensemble project, I realize the video component of that is crucial. You need to see the interaction. It's really, it's almost like, okay, no one got to watch Pink Floyd make Dark Side of the Moon, but you can watch these people try and watch their fingertips on instruments. You can see maybe what's required. And I think that's informative and entertaining. And maybe if you're on a good day, it heightens the value of the music. My old friends back in the 80s were, you know, hated music videos because their argument was, this is ruining the music. The music stands alone. All this visual stuff is distracting. And I think, you know, it can be, but the best videos do, I think, more than the music.
Well, I'm sorry. We've been talking for a while and haven't talked about your record yet.
Tends to happen, right? Right. My album. Yes. Okay.
Which I am, you can probably tell, I'm such a prog head. And when I tuned into this, I was like, oh, this is great.
Thank you. I mean, I think for, again, some of us of a certain vintage, prog is not a dirty word. I mean, I grew up in the later part of the 70s trying to catch up. So all through, from like 74 up through to 80, I was a Beatlemaniac, learning, buying, discovering. In fact, for a little while, that's all I did. And then I got a book, like I think it was the Rolling Stone Record Guide or something. And it was telling me, oh, there's more than the Beatles. I should probably hear this stuff. All right, they've ranked the albums 5 stars. I'll get all the 5-star albums and then I'll know what rock is. So you introduce yourself to Dark Side of the Moon, and I introduce myself to, you know, Yes and Crimson, and I really loved that early 70s prog moment for me, just as a budding musician, as a songwriter. Even the stuff that was somewhat contemporary, like I was discovering The Who at the same time that Pete Townsend's putting out Empty Glass, and you're thinking, that's not prog. But it's pretty prog adjacent. I mean, he can take complex structures and compress them down into a 4-minute song. And I was finding that and then saying, okay, so Yes could do this over a whole side of an album, but themes return, themes, variation, all these sort of composerly kind of ways of thinking. I didn't pick that up in a music school. I picked that up listening to these albums. And though, even though my songwriting sort of moved, sort of stayed in maybe a more pop focus, I find that sometimes, even when I think I've written a fairly straight ahead song, it's got, for want of a better word, it's got some prog leanings that are, you can sniff them out. And as I've gotten a little bit older, I've become far less defensive about the prog component and thought, no, why not? If you hear that stuff, why not do that stuff? I think growing up, it was a little bit like, yeah, but I don't know any other players that could pull this off. But now that I'm an old man, I've lived a life of meeting musicians, and I've got all these great people that I can work with that can do it. The drummer that I met in music school when I was 18, we've been playing together now for 40 years. And same with the bass player, mostly. I just know, like, okay, Ben can do anything. So if I've got something that's shifting meters back and forth, it's going to require him to be multidextrous and think outside the box in his kit playing, he'll be able to do it. And he'll be able to do it with like one listen and a 1-minute conversation. It's kind of scary. But it's wonderful to feel like any idea I have, I know people that can pull it off. So you don't limit yourself, you know. And I think probably the best prog bands, they know that going in, that, okay, everyone in the room can do anything that we can dream of. So let's decide what's the best idea to pursue. Of course, that's where they all fight. But, you know, I think as a listener, when you hear musicians challenging themselves, I know some people would say, you know, okay, that's just kind of muso masturbation. But I actually think when a musician's working with another musician and something is happening, even if it's the simplest idea that's fully committed to, it's kind of the same as the most complex idea that's fully committed to. I think for me, it's the commitment that we register. So anyway, I'm glad that you hear the prog in it and that that's not a dirty word.
No. And I think of it too. Like, I mean, just like to me, a band like Tears for Fears is that good melding point where you've got these very tuneful songs, but then it's like, oh, there's some musicianship happening.
Exactly. And that's why, like, I know Stephen Wilson, you know, was like, I'm going to redo these things too in surround sound, because, and I think he kind of has, there's a quote about him saying, yes, it's pop, but it's not a dirty word. In fact, this has been as much enjoyment for me as a musician, understanding what audio was capable of doing, the soundscapes, particularly on the highlights of Seeds of Love. That's a bit indulgent, an album, but the best stuff is pretty jaw-dropping. And, you know, I think for him, it was a sonic landscape he really wanted to work in. I remember being really deeply into Songs from the Big Chair when it came out and being a little turned off by Sowing the Seeds of Love, mostly because it seemed like this is such an overt 60s throwback. I found it a little too, and maybe it was just the moment, because there was the XTC skylarking. There seemed to be a Prince Around the World in a Day. It just was like, what is the Paisley fascination at the moment? I don't know. In retrospect now, I don't really like the Prince Around the World in a Day, and I'm a diehard Prince fan. That album just doesn't work for me. I bought the new mix or new mastering version, still doesn't work. But the other stuff has really grown on me. There are those categories we make sometimes after the fact that don't quite hold up because they exclude things that should maybe be more part of, like thinking of Tears for Fears as related to anything that a Yes or a Genesis or a, I don't know, what, a Rush. Not, I mean, I understand that when you move towards Tool and that sort of thing, it's harder to hear that Tool and Tears for Fears is the same music. But I don't know. There are places where they also overlap.
Are you familiar with Kevin Gilbert's?
Yeah, a little bit. Not deeply, but...
Yeah. Yeah, just that concept of, you know, I think that band Toy Matinee, the idea was like, we're going to be the Steely Dan for the 90s.
Right.
And have these really tuneful songs with all the muso stuff.
Yeah, there was somebody else in that band. Was it Patrick Leonard? I don't know. Anyways, one that kind of... Yeah. Those folks at that moment that seemed to be bringing studio-oriented pop production, but clearly informed by a much broader set of histories. And I guess, sure, you could even say Steely Dan at the time. That's, I'm not sure I would have put Steely Dan and King Crimson as the same band or the same genre even. But with some distance, you hear more parallels. I mean, I was just thinking the other day, some old track came on, and I was like, that's a nice sax solo. Hey, whatever happened to the sax solo? That used to be on everything. Bands that didn't have sax players would still bring in the sax player. And you're thinking, right, Steely Dan does it. So does King Crimson. So does Pink Floyd. So does Supertramp. So does, like, and there were a bunch of 80s stuff. I think it was Duran Duran I was listening to, of all things. I was like, oh, a sax solo. I was thinking I need to go back and see what's the most recent pop song that had a sax solo. What happened?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Tastes change. And then why? Why is the sax there? That's not a guitar-oriented, that's not a garage band kind of thing. And it's interesting to think, okay, I know there's an orchestra on whatever Yes's second album. I don't remember any woodwind sax solos on Yes tracks. We've got Peter Gabriel doing whatever he thinks he's doing to his flute on the early Genesis, but it's not until the 80s version where they bring in the Earth, Wind & Fire horns that we get horns on Genesis. But other bands, saxes were part of it. You can find sax solos on Beatles, on Stones, on Floyd, maybe not Zeppelin. Anyway, it's funny to sort of do the Rolodexes of trying to find these instruments.
Yeah, I was going to say for a second, oh, it was the jazz thing, but then yes, those guys were jazz heads, so yeah, why didn't they have a sax?
Why not, right? Because other bands were doing it. And it can sometimes be effective, but it sort of signals a genre that's being pulled in. You know, like sax is not rock. Yeah, sax is jazz, but we're going to bring it in, which makes sense for Steely Dan. Somehow makes a little less sense for me for the other bands that do it, but they do it. There's no sax on my album. There is on the prior album. I did put a horn section on one track on the other album. Yeah.
There's that density there musically, but then again, it's not so overpowering, right? Still tuneful, it's still all those things that we want. And I just think it's unique in that way that it's got those sensibilities that we've been talking about.
Yeah, thank you. I think part of it is if I go out to play, which I don't do very much, but if I do, I can't afford to bring a band. So I've got to have a body of work that will work solo. And I'm not a guitar virtuoso. I'm really a piano player who's stopped playing keys and picked up a guitar. So I think that sometimes keeps the songs a little more direct, a little more focused in that regard. And then for the recordings, I can expand the arrangements. And there's some songs that in more recent years that I've decided, you know, I'll probably never play that live because it doesn't work solo, but it doesn't mean I shouldn't make the song. So I think there's a handful of tracks on the new record that I probably won't perform live, or at least solo. We're going to do a big show at the university to celebrate the album, and those it's like the opportunity to say, oh, you know what, do the songs that you may never get a chance to have three guitar players and a drummer. Go ahead and let's do the more expansive ones for the concert, just so you know what it's like to do that song live. The more stripped down ballad stuff, you'll get plenty of chances to do that. Maybe not so much at the concert. We'll see. Anyway, I think as a writer, a lot of the stuff stays a little more straight ahead because that's often just how they fall under fingers and the song is born. Left to my devices, I can start before the song is finished, start constructing the mix in my head, and then you start expanding form sometimes there, like, ah, you know what could happen would be, and I start thinking more like a composer orchestrating, and then it's like, well, I'm going to allow that to happen. Maybe it's got multiple sections. Maybe these songs will expand. I think on the new record, there's really nothing quite like that. I think the stuff that's on the new record that's maybe the closest to a progressive structural thing is there's a song called Feel No Pain, and that's in multimeters and has a crazy virtuoso guitar solo and that whole nine yards. But that was one that did come sitting down playing guitar, and I realized it's actually really simple. My part is, I'll let everybody else do the hard parts. And you know, so with the song, I could probably do it live, but I don't think it would be, it's not meant to be heard in that way. It's really meant to have the power of a band behind it. And other stuff, you can almost sort of do different versions and they both work.
You know, I know a lot of people wind up with a faculty appointment and they work with their students, but if they've composed or made records, that sometimes kind of falls. How did you manage to stick with that?
I first started making recordings while I was teaching as a way of just escaping the teaching part of it. And somebody finally pulled me inside and said, you know, what you're doing creatively can count as research. I was like, oh, you mean I don't have to hide this stuff? They were like, no, stop hiding it. You need to bring it into what you're doing. So then I started to realize, okay, right. So if I'm creating something, I'm learning a little bit. I bring that into the classroom. Maybe I can bring some students into the project. I remember bringing students to witness a string overdub section and say, come on out, see how we're miking up the thing, see how we're doing the tracking and layers, see how that works. One of the times we did that, we got lucky because a power supply in the mixing console blew. I've got 20 string players that I'm paying in a nice room, but nothing is working. And the audio students happened to be there, and they got together with the engineer, and they pulled out all the portable gear that they had for tracking symphonies and whatever. And these guys are running lines out and hanging mics, and they saved the session. So it was kind of a great learning experience, and thank God they were there. But I feel like, yeah, often the teaching has helped facilitate the creation of the music. Where it gets in the way is it's just impossible to go out and play. You got to be in your classroom. And then you've got these open blocks of time where you could be going out to play, but you needed to book those gigs while you were deeply immersed in all of your teaching. So it just never quite lined up that well for me. And now, while I still have breath, although it doesn't sound like I do, I am retiring so that I can go out and make some music, basically. So this is sort of my last semester, my farewell. And it'll be interesting to see once I can no longer blame the day job on why I'm not getting music out there. Can I fill that void with some music?
Do you feel as you retire, do you feel like I don't want to put you on the spot, but that your school will be kind of in good hands, that there are people who are ready to pick up the work? And
for sure. What's really interesting, because I've been around at the same place for 30 odd years now, you see people come and go, and there are people that, the guy that founded the sound recording program, he's still around as an emeritus teaching the occasional course, but he backed out a few years ago. And I thought, there's no way this can keep going with Will Moylan no longer at the helm, but of course it does. And there are people who, the scary lesson I learned is, it's amazing how quickly forgotten people are. Like, don't be thinking about legacies. You're just instantly erased. And I learned that certainly by watching other people, but right after the pandemic, I took a year-long sabbatical. So I hadn't been in person in a classroom for a year, then I was gone for a year. So I get back into the building after basically 2 years away. Nobody knows me. Nobody recognizes. Like, I have no idea who that old guy is walking down the hallway. They just have no clue. And you start to feel like a ghost. And I thought, this is what it's like to, to attend your own funeral. They're going to get along perfectly well without me. Therefore, I don't worry about it. I look around, I see new people coming in. And part of the thing is, in some ways, get out of the way, make room for the new ideas, the new energy. And I would like to think that the whole building will collapse the day I don't show up, but it's not going to happen. And that's really good.
You've been listening to a conversation with Alan Williams. His new album, Floating on the Dreamline, is out now. You can learn more about him and his music at alanwilliamsevidence.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. And find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening, and as always, we like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson. See you next time.